My name is Joe, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Joe.
And I will, he gave me the preface here. I'm up here well instructed, so if I... First, I'd like to say that the Saturday evening program is nothing like it's written. We've had to substitute a preacher. I don't know where that other one is. Maybe out in one of our local bars, I hope. And I'm substituting for the chairman. And there's another thing that's not on the program. After the meeting tonight, Jack O and I will do a water ballet with Father Ken doing the choreography. And I'm going to swap the usual preamble about Alcoholics Anonymous as a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope, and read from another little amusing thing that's very similar to it that catches my eye, and I think it's a little bit closer to home. It says, Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship designed and administrated by a bunch of ex-drunks whose only qualification for membership is that they can't hold their whiskey and don't want to learn how. It has no rules, dues, or fees, no nothing that any sensible organization seems to require. At meetings, the speakers start on one subject and end up talking about something entirely different. Concluding by saying, I don't really know anything about the program except that it works. The groups are always broke, but always seem to have money. They're always losing members, but always seem to grow. They claim AA is a selfish program, but always seem to be doing something for others. Every group passes laws, rules, edicts, and pronouncements, which everybody blindly ignores. Members who disagree with anything are privileged to walk out in a huff, quitting forever, only to return at the next meeting as though nothing had happened. Nothing is ever planned more than 24 hours ahead, yet great projects are born and survive magnificently. Nothing in AA is according to Hoyle. How can it survive? Perhaps it is because we have learned to laugh at ourselves. God made man. He made laughter too. Perhaps he's pleased with our poor efforts and makes everything run right, no matter who pushes the wrong button. Maybe he's pleased not with our perfection, but with our sincerity. Maybe he is pleased because we're trying to be nobody but ourselves. We don't know how, but it works. And members keep receiving their dividend checks from the AA investment. This is one of the finest preambles I've ever read. It's customary for in our speaker's country that somebody reads from the big book a little bit. I'm going to read two paragraphs out of our book of experience before I introduce what's his name. It And I... And after the meeting, we'll play a little game here. I'm not going to tell you where this comes out of the book. You come tell me where it does after it's over with. This is two of my favorite paragraphs in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And it goes like this. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And those psychiatrists just had me convinced it was because my mama put me on the pot backwards. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the truth from the false. To them, their alcoholic life is the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over unless this person can experience an entire psychic change. There is very little hope of his recovery. On the other hand, and as strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. I have been up in the position that our speaker has been in, is in tonight, suffering the rigors of hell, waiting for some long-winded chairman to introduce me. I went to his state one time and sat up on a platform with my knees showing. One of the elder statesmen preempted me for 48 minutes. And I'm going to get even with him tonight. I think one of the greatest experiences I ever had recently, I was out in a little town called Baker, Oregon, and it lasted for 4 days. We had a little meeting out there in the boondocks, and all the people came in from the brush, the cowboys and whatnot, and there was a little girl and her boyfriend that came in, and her hair was very stringy. And they both looked the worse for wear. And she was shaking, and so was he. And the next day at the meeting, they looked no better. And they just looked like they were having an awful hard time. And then Saturday night, I made one of the most beautiful talks that you've ever heard. And after the meeting, after all the folks had told me how nice it was, she came up, the little girl with the stringy hair, and she said, "You talked about resentments tonight." Said, "I'll tell you how to get rid of them." And I said, "How's that?" She said, "Get even with the son of a bitch." No, it's a privilege and a pleasure to introduce a feller like this, as hard as they tried getting somebody to do it. But I've run across Clancy throughout the country from one end to the other, and he's always, and I like to use this word, incited me to do better. And he bugged me for a long time, and I thought, well, what the hell is there about this fella that makes him like he is? And I asked him, what's about Clancy? And one fella said, well, just to know him is to hate him. And I got out in his home group out on the West Coast, and I asked the fella, what about Clancy? And he said, well, beneath that dapper exterior, this beautifully and impeccable outside, inside there beats a heart of pure garbage. And I thought, well, this can't be all right, because the fact that he's here spells something. And I ran into a writer friend of his and mine, who's our mutual friend, both of them. He lives out there and writes for one of the television shows. And we sat down one night not so long ago in Lexington, Kentucky, and took all of our friends' inventories. And somewhere along there, Clancy's name came up, and I said, well, what's about Clancy? And he said, well, I just don't quite understand him. But if I were going to describe him, I would say that he's a frightened little man who's afraid to go to AA by himself. And I didn't answer the question, and we separated, and I thought about it that night, and I thought, my God, what a compliment. I wish that somebody would say that about me. This is our obligation in AA. This is how it works, to be afraid to go to AA by yourself. This is what the whole thing's all about. I wouldn't blow any smoke at them, but I'm going to say that the cake is in the eating, and that he gives away more birthday chips than anybody I know, because he's scared to go to AA by himself. And for your edification, I will now give you Clancy with a last name that defies pronunciation.
My name is Clancy Immislund, and I'm an alcoholic. And that's about all the time we have before the dance, friends. I am glad to be here tonight, safe and sane and sober, as I like to say every time I start to talk, because I haven't always been safe and sane and sober. And based on the track record that we see around us, it's possible I may not be safe and sane and sober again someday in the future. And again, I say this for my own information, not yours, certainly. But it's something I always like to remember. I have seen people with much longer sobriety than I have, who have been among the strongest pioneers in our organization, who have somehow been able to allow themselves to disjoint their connections with AA to a point where they can rationalize that it's all right to take a drink, and bring much sorrow, I'm sure, to many people in AA. In fact, yesterday, I was sitting, I forget who it was with, someone here, and they said to me, what's happening in AA lately? It seems like there's several old-timers getting drunk. And I said, no, I don't see anything different. It's been that way as long as I've been around AA. Every once in a while, an old-timer gets drunk. When newcomers get drunk, it doesn't leave much of a splash, you know, just one more newcomer didn't like her anyway, you know. But when an old-timer gets drunk, it makes everybody kind of look inside themselves. And when it's someone you know well, I think the way I could best describe it was on February 9th, the whole city of Los Angeles felt that way briefly. Because everybody woke up to one big alarm clock at 6 o'clock in the morning. And everybody thought they were going to die for a minute when that whole boom started going. And it was a very quiet town that day. Everybody went around very quietly because everybody had looked into eternity for a minute that morning. And I think that happens sometimes in AA. When someone who's been sober a long time and that has been kind of a legend to us gets drunk, it makes us all kind of look within ourselves and say, my God, if he can't stay sober, how can I? And that sometimes happens to people. They get drunk after they've been around AA a while. And I have seen people whose spiritual growth has far exceeded mine, evidently, because they state it has. And they tell me they have. Some of them have become God's franchisees on earth. And they pass in and out of the groups, invoking the blessings of the celestial being. I sometimes ask to see their license. I'd like to ask to see their license. But I... S. E. Miller. S. E. Miller. S. E. Miller. It's an emergency. Your mother is calling. S. E. Miller. Well, you want to draw another name? Winner must be present. I swear to God, I go to thousands of AA meetings all the time, and the only ones the notes ever come up to when I'm talking, I'll be... Now I'll have to start over again. I've lost my place. Don't misunderstand me. I, no means, since this is a spiritual program, do I intend or even want to have you get the feeling right. I'd want you to infer that I'm implying anything against the spiritual aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm talking about self-appointed spiritual leaders who get to such a ivory tower that pretty soon they forget where they came from. And sometimes they get drunk. And you want to know, sometimes after they get drunk, they swear and things. But fortunately, usually in 2 or 3 months, they're back giving advice on how to work the program again. I know that can happen to me. Sometimes I've had the temptation many times, because those of you who know me know that at best I'm a smart aleck. And my babies sometimes call this to my attention. They say, God, you know, you could really be such a nice guy. Why don't you just try to simmer down a while? Don't make any controversies. We don't have to keep defending you all the time. And about once a year, I go through a phase where I'm going to take on a kind of a gray veneer, kind of a Hi. How have you been? And I last about 4 days, and then I just... Ah! I just can't stand it. But I'm making progress. I used to be able to do it for a few hours. I'm up to 4 days now. But I dread the day... I hope the day never comes when I can do it all the time. Because then you people will be much beneath me. And I'll just drop by to check on you once in a while. There are many paths, it seems like, that enable people to get drunk again. And I know that puzzles me. How can I be certain? I can't be certain, obviously. How can anybody be certain? There's no way anyone in this room can guarantee they're going to be sober next week. That's a ridiculous thing, but it's true. It's true. And yet people do stay sober here. And I suppose the reason I like to talk about the fact that it can happen to me is because it keeps it from happening a little bit. Because when I remember that I am still susceptible to alcohol, despite how much I know or where I've been or who I've sponsored or what I've done, if I remember it can still happen to me, I will keep doing the things to keep it from happening. If I get to the point of thinking, I now know enough, it can't happen to me anymore, then I will stop doing the things that'll keep it from happening. And then it's liable to happen. And it's kind of an upside down switch. So I have to keep doing the same things that dummies do. And I identify, which is even worse. I am most pleased to be back in Texas. Most of you know I have been in Texas before under various situations. I've been to Texas to talk at meetings. I've been to Texas to get shock treatments. I've been confined in the Texas Nut House. I have been given up on in Texas. I taught at a college in Texas. I've done a lot of things in Texas. I hitchhiked into Texas and I hitchhiked back out. You know. The only difference is I lost 40 pounds in my three front teeth on the way out. But I am not really here tonight as an outstanding example, I don't think, of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know many people in this room. The dreaded Al B. here, who has told me three different little stories before the banquet that I... made the hair in the back of my neck stand up, Al. I'm too spiritual for those kind of stories. You should have been around in the old days, Al. Things were different. We were sincere then. Many outstanding members of Alcoholics Anonymous here, whose progress I am sure is much greater than mine on any arbitrary scale. I suppose in a sense I represent another facet of Alcoholics Anonymous. I represent that facet of that gives some degree of assurance to those who don't grow as rapidly as others. And I can't help but feel that no matter where you are, you're doing better than I did. Because my growth was very slow, and I have a long way to go yet. And the only thing I can tell you is that I have discovered one thing in the past few years. There's no place you ever got to get to, no matter anybody tells you. All you got to do is do a little better than you used to do last month. And everybody here starts differently. And we have a tendency, I think, sometimes, to judge whether or not people are going to make it by if they sound the way I want them to sound. Like in any meeting, or maybe six or seven people new, at least in our home group. There's always six or seven people who raise their hands new out of those 200. And I even though I know better, I get trapped into listening to hear the type of newcomer I want to hear. I want to hear newcomers who stand up and say, I'm just so proud to be here. I've searched the world over for a way of life. With you wonderful folks, I found it. And I just think, yeah, baby, you're the type of newcomer we're looking for. And behind him comes some scrubby goof who says, this is the goddamnedest worst night of my life. And the trouble is, those kind of people stay around and you never see the good guys again, you know. It's almost as though it's better to be honest than it is to be look good. And I know that I spent many years around Alcoholics Anonymous saying what people thought I should say. And I drank a lot. And I finally got so desperate that nobody cared what I said anymore, so I just said truthful things. And nobody liked me, but I stayed sober. And now I can say them and they're taken as wisdom. Yeah. The only difference between being a newcomer goof and a wise man is a lot of time sober, that's all. It's sometimes. If you can just out, like Joe said, he had about this young lady up in Oregon and said, get even with him. My old sponsor gave me a better line than that. I said, you know, that guy is going to get me. He bugs me. He puts me down at meetings. He won't ever call on me to read the steps just because I haven't got any front teeth. He against me. He stinks. He says, you want to get him? Outlast the son of a bitch. And for some people, it's not the best motive there is. But I've come to believe that motives are a very small import in this organization. If we have to depend on our good motives to stay sober, my motives aren't always that good to stay sober. And so I want to stay. I think the first law, we get sometimes caught up. I get sometimes caught up, and many people I know sometimes get caught up, so much in the philosophical nuances of what the steps really mean, what Dr. Bob would have said if he'd have been there to answer Bill that time, or did you hear the tape of the new cure on alcoholism out of Canada, or whatever it may be, sometimes we forget that all of this is meaningless unless you survive. You can be the smartest, knowledgeable person in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you don't survive, it isn't worth a pitcher of warm spit. It's worth nothing. Nothing. And I think that's a good topic for me. That's something we seem to miss sometimes. Sometimes we get so wrapped up in philosophies and describing the true meaning of the steps that I have to go back to 1958 when I got sober. In California, and I was only in California because I was en route to Seattle, and I was en route to Seattle because I was hot in Texas, and if they could catch me, they were going to put me back in Big Spring and keep me there till I rotted. And I looked at my map and I thought I'd go for a yellow state this time. These blue states really are rotten. But I couldn't get out of Los Angeles, and I was around. In fact, there's a young lady tonight here, Betty, who lives in Tyler, who I last saw when I was a newcomer in Los Angeles. And I didn't have any front teeth, and I was scrawny and dirty and living off and on the backseat of an abandoned car, and I haven't seen her since till today. And saw her tonight. Turns out she's turned out well, and she brought me a box of candy. I say, wherever you are, Betty, you're all right. But we had mutual friends. But I, at that time, I knew all there was to know about AA. I never knew anybody that could quote the book better than I could when I was drunk. And I'd been to meetings, and I had good sponsors. And I had a good sponsor in Dallas, who was a wonderful man. And I had a good sponsor in El Paso, who was a wonderful man. And I had a good sponsor in San Francisco. And I had a good sponsor in Chicago. And I had a good sponsor in Milwaukee. And I had a good sponsor in Rockford. And I had, Christ, I had... My sponsors were wonderful men, because I've gone back to see every one of them since I've been sober, and they're still sober and doing fine. So I know they were telling me the right things, and the things that I think I've discovered in AA and I tell them about, they say, yes, we told you that in 1950, but I didn't hear it quite that way. But in 1958, I got sober in AA, and I didn't get sober because I wanted sobriety, because I didn't want sobriety. Sobriety is for alcoholics who have a drinking problem. It isn't for sick, screwed up people who need to drink to keep reality from driving them crazy. There may be people to which reality is a wonderful thing. I sometimes wonder what the hell. I envy folks I hear at AA meetings sometimes who say, and then I knew I needed AA on an all-time basis. So I opened the door to this wonderful program, and I came in, and I knew I was home, and I never thought about a drink again. I thought, if I had that, I wouldn't need AA. You know, I'd just come in one door and get that feeling and keep right on going, Slim. You know. But I got down to, I was just about dying in late 1958, and I was living in the back end of an abandoned car, and I'd been sober a few weeks, and I'd just been discharged as a janitor in a jewelry shop where the guy noticed I was dusting dangerously close to his jewels. And his jewels in the counter. We Californians have to make that clear. You know, in many parts of the world in AA, the old saying goes, we use the 12 steps to separate the men from the boys. In our group, we also need a crowbar some night. But I knew a great deal about AA, and I knew the theory of AA, and I knew the concept of AA, and I knew what it was about, and I knew what it was supposed to do, and I knew that AA could not help me, because even though I had a drinking problem, it was made more complicated by a grave emotional disorder that had been identified by psychiatrists, that had been identified by psychiatrists in the Navy, had been identified by psychiatrists in the Veterans Hospital, that had been identified by psychiatrists at El Paso County Psycho Ward and also at Big Spring and most places I'd gone. I had a severe emotional problem that they could not quite find a way to overcome. They tried. They poured enough electricity in my head at Big Spring to... if any reversal was possible, that could have reversed it. They gave me quite a bit of alternating current, and they got me in the wrong cycle, I guess. I had lost everything. Now, what are you going to tell a guy who knows the steps and knows the book and knows all about AA and has heard all the speakers and knows, been to all the meetings and been in and out for 9 years? What are you going to tell him? I'll tell you what an old guy told me. He told me that I should try the steps. And I told him that I knew the steps, and I'd tried the steps, and that he didn't seem to understand that my case was somewhat different. That maybe it'll help you to turn your problems over to Jesus. But it never did much for me. Did you notice that? A backhand shot into the ashtray. Was that nice? Well, no. For those Bill O'Neill, I want to put this on your tape. That's over 4 feet away I made that. And I think the first three steps of AA is what he pointed out to me as the steps. And I know there are some new people here tonight, and I know there are some people who are just back from field investigation. Some It's funnier to talk about it than it is to do it, I'll tell you. But there are people here who are just back from drinking bouts. And I know some people who are just back from pill bouts, which is the same proposition. Exactly, it seems to me. And I think that it's incumbent upon me occasionally to remember what I am here for. I am here, I drank a great deal, of course, but that was not, stopping drinking was not the answer for me. I took pills, but stopping taking pills was not the answer. I smoked marijuana, but stopping smoking marijuana was not the answer. Because something intruded upon myself many years ago that I thought I was the only one that knew, and that was merely this. Sobriety is not enough. Sobriety is not enough. If sobriety is enough, then there is no need for Alcoholics Anonymous. If sobriety is enough, all we have to do is go and get sober and learn our lesson. Maybe we can show movies. I always like to think of that as an example. You know, we can show movies of what happens to the liver when you drink and what happens to your head. And just like we used to get when I was first went in the Navy and they showed these VD films. Some of us small town boys made us hot. You know, it was just terrible. I never knew things like that existed until I saw those movies. I've been looking for that girl ever since. She's a stunner. But we could show movies and say, if you don't stop drinking, this is what's going to happen. In fact, that's the new cure. Have you read about it in the paper? About a month ago out at Loma Linda University in California, they now take movies of people when they're drunk. Then the next time they feel like drinking, they show them the movie. And that cures them. Until the projector burns out or something, I guess. But they used to do that years ago. There's been many cures to help people stop drinking. In 1958, 2 months after I got sober, there was a cure at UCLA Medical Center, big hospital at the University of California, Los Angeles. And I volunteered for that cure. And I was turned down because I was too sick. I was not an adequate cause. And so I missed it. They took 10 volunteers from the 6300 Club, the AA Club, and gave them the cure which would enable them to solve their problem of alcoholism. And with this new drug they had come across that gave people insight. And I missed it. You know what the name of that drug was? LSD. And there's only one of those people still alive. That's what happened to the people who got cured in 1958. If I'd have been a little more well, I'd have been dead, for Christ's sake. A couple years ago, a wonderful hospital started in Seattle to cure alcoholics, to help them return to social drinking through enzyme adjusting of enzyme imbalances. And that's been doing well. Their attendance has dropped off a little bit because about 4 months ago, the executive director, who was a cured alcoholic, had to be hauled away to the acute alcoholic ward for acute alcoholism. His cure had slipped. And so they... But there are... I know this, that I got to have something. Because when I get sober, unlike real alcoholics, I always felt, unlike those real alcoholics, when I get sober, it's only good for a little while and then I get crazy. And I don't know why this is. Why can't I be like you real alcoholics who come into the program and find happiness and love and rewards, and old employers stumble over one another to offer you jobs back? Christ, families pile off of trains and planes, and You're remembered in people's will. Heard you've been sober 3 days. Here's $100,000. And I had to accept the fact that I was crazy. And fortunately, through the working of the steps of AA, begrudgingly and over a period of time, I came to understand that that is why I'm in AA. Is because, not because what I thought it was. I thought AA was a place where you go to get sober, and it turned out, I guess most of us know by now, AA is not a place to get sober. You don't need AA to get sober. You want to get sober? Go in the bathroom and puke for a while. You get sober. You get sober under your bed. You get sober in your bed. You can get sober in a jail. You can get sober out of a jail. You get sober in a hospital. Eventually, your body will always make you sober. But the problem is, what do you do after you are sober and you can't stand sobriety? What people do, like us, we have a tendency to drink alcohol, or we have a tendency to take pills, or we have a tendency to induce chemicals into our system. And so they give us a series of steps to take that look to be the rottenest group of therapeutics ever put together anywhere in the world. They're designed for little old ladies in white tennis shoes who live in the Green Hotel in Pasadena. You know, they come out once a year to clip a coupon out of their bond book, and I'm going to turn it over, and I'm going to help you write my inventory. You know. But what is it really like on the job when somebody's looking at you and says, "You stink"? You know, what step do you use then? What steps? If you don't pay for your car, we're going to come and get it on your job where you work. They did that to me in Dallas. I couldn't think of what step to use, and so they came and got the goddamn car. Guy in the Phoenix tank told me one time, he says, "You know, I don't like your looks. I'm going to knock you on your ass." And I didn't know what to say, and by the time I could think of anything, he knocked me on my ass. Just like that. When you get under pressure like that, it's hard to come up with reactions. But somehow, something here must help, or else we would all be in deep trouble. So just for a few minutes tonight, I want to talk for my own benefit. I want to talk about what happened to me briefly after I got sober and the first three steps of AA. The first three steps are I always remember as being kind of goofy steps. They are goofy steps. First, you're going to admit you're the world's worst drunk and that you're all screwed up. Secondly, you're going to come to believe that God's going to make it all better and make you well when you're not even crazy. And third, you're going to turn your problems over to God. Try that some morning when you can't pay your rent. Here, God. That night you'll be turning things over in the street, I'll tell you. Now, these don't have much to do with the real business of living. And I remember a guy telling me about those steps. He said, "Kid," he said, "I'm so sick of you pseudo-intellectuals coming around here. You wear horn-rimmed glasses and you think you're smart. You used to be a college teacher." He says, "You don't know nothing. Why don't you just try the black parts of those words? Just the black parts. Why don't you stop reading into them?" And he pointed out to me a little something that said, the first step says, "We admitted we were powerless over alcohol." He said, "Kid, that don't mean that you got drunk and stayed drunk for 40 years. He says, "That don't mean that you just, every time you took a glass of beer, that your hair grew long and you attacked nuns out of bushes, you know. It means that sooner or later, when you drank to excess." And I think that's true. I sooner or later drank to excess for whatever reason. But the nice thing about being new in AA, you don't even have to admit that you drank more or less than anybody else. This is not a competition. All you have to admit, we admitted that I lost my power to control alcohol. And it doesn't mean that every single time I took a sip of alcohol, I ran amok. That isn't how you judge it. How you judge it is, when I began to drink, I could not guarantee that I would not get drunk or would get drunk or whatever. And I said, but that's all right. But you see, Sully, these people, they're crazy when they're sober. Or they're crazy when they're drunk. I'm crazy when I'm sober. Because the first step says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, therefore our lives had become unmanageable. And he said, that isn't what the black parts say, you little punk. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, dash. In the English language, a dash means end of thought, beginning of new thought. That our lives had become unmanageable. He doesn't have to say that your life is unmanageable when you're drunk. Everybody's life is unmanageable when they're drunk. That's got to do with alcoholism. I have a little, you know, people say, well, I got crazy. Craziness to me isn't what I did when I was drunk. Craziness to me is what I'm afraid I do when I'm sober or when I have to drink. My grandmother in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, has never had a drink in her life. But I'm sure if I got her enough Muscatel, I could get her to do a lot of things she wouldn't ordinarily do, you know. Let's drive down the wrong way on the freeway. The hardest acknowledgement that I have to make here, to accept, I can say it, but it's hard to accept, is this. I must be willing to accept the fact that the point of this whole program is that my life is unmanageable sober. My life is unmanageable sober. It's easy to say it, but it's hard to remember it sometimes. Because the thought comes back, now I'm sober! Now I can run it! You know. And that's when people like me go crazy. That's when I go crazy. But that's what you can believe if you think you're here to get sober. If you're here to get sober, then you're well right now. But somehow I got to come to understand that I'm here not to get sober, but here to keep from beginning to drink the next time I can't stand being sober. Where I need help. The first lesson of AA, the black parts merely say, all I have to accept or admit is that I've had some problems in my control of alcohol and that my life has been unmanageable. And when I read those few words, as the guy pointed out to me, he says, you don't have to admit it's your fault. Blame them if you want to. But it's obvious you and them ain't making it. Blame them if you want to. But somebody's wrong, you know. No wonder you drink, you poor baby. I hear people say, I've never been able to get the first step. First step is easy to get. All you've said is that you drink too much and it's their fault, for Christ's sake. There's nothing hard in the first step. Somehow or other, they and I have gotten out of sync. And we don't blend anymore. We go like that. But you get in that second step and it gets a little spooky then. And it says, came to believe that a power greater than myself. Now, I don't know about you, and I know that in some circles this part of the world is known as the Bible Belt. But you're nothing compared to the Norwegian Lutheran Church in northern Wisconsin. That is the Bible Belt. Really, because up there, if you even smile, you're suspect. You know. What is, if he keeps going like that, he's going to become a Catholic. Yeah. <You know. laughs> You're an Episcopalian, aren't you? Yes. As I like to say, some of my best friends now are Catholics. I wouldn't want my daughter to marry one. But she'll have to because my daughter's a Catholic, so she'll have to. I just don't want my daughter to marry a priest. I think it looks bad in the family. But I was raised in a very, very religious atmosphere. I have always known about God. Many people have not known about God, and they've been denied God. But I've known about God in a God that left me with a solid impression that if God truly exists, I am going to go to hell. There is no way out. I knew that when I was 6 years old. Because in my church, there were 10 big ones on the wall, and if you broke any of them, you go to hell. And by the first time I could read them at 6, I'd broken 2 of them already. Get them. But all you can do then is break the rest first chance you get. If you're going, you might as well go with the band playing on the deck. You know. And as I grew older, I became a young intellectual. I got horn-rimmed glasses before I needed glasses. I became a young intellectual, and I joined in other snot noses like me who debated God with one another and talked about God being a figment of the imagination and giving those arguments that I've used many times when I talk about if God exists, let him strike me dead. If God exists, why does Lucky Luciano live in Naples with all kinds of broads and booze and drugs and everything and music? And 90 miles away, the Pope dies screaming a cancer. Is that God rewarding his vicar on earth? If God exists, how come Louis Lepke Buckhalter sends his kids to a private school in Chicago and he lives off dope and prostitution, and down on the other end of town, a train hits a school bus of little underprivileged Catholic children, leaves them strewn along the high sea tracks for 3 miles? Is this God in action? If God is in action, if God lives, why is the world in war? If God lives, why is sin rewarded and virtue punished? And if you work on that hard enough, you can come to disbelieve in God most of the time. Just when you get tired or cross, every once in a while a thought shoots across your head. That's all very true, but you're going to hell, you son of a bitch. Then it's time to start talking again, quickly. And I searched for another version of God. I went to back porches with other dumbbells and read deep transcendental philosophical gambits and smelled incense and drank red wine till dawn and talked about the real deep karma of life, and doesn't do any good. The sun still comes up and there you are, nothing, just nothing. But one thing that always has been guaranteed to drive me away from AA when I got there was someone start giving me a God shot. Isn't it about time that you found a little deeper understanding of a God? My answer to that is not spiritual. It always was just about the same. Why don't you go screw yourself? Which is a terrible thing to say, but that's the only defense I had, and soon I got drunk. Now, they give you in that step, came to believe that a power greater than yourself, and there it is again. And I said to Sullivan, Sully, I'm not going to take it. I'll jump that step. And he said, kid, why don't you get off it? Over a period of time, he says, I'm just synthesizing it. He and my sponsor, Bob, used to give me these shots. He says, nothing in that step says God. It says you got to come to believe in a power greater than yourself. And do you want to know something? I'm a power greater than you are. And so is everybody else. He says, and if you don't think there's a power greater than yourself, you go out in front of this club and take off your clothes under that street light. And you'll see a power greater than yourself in a black and white car come right up and nail you. He says, all you got to do is come to believe that a power greater than yourself exists. Some people believe in a sponsor. Some people believe in a group. Some people believe in an abstract deity. He says, you don't have to worry about that. You just have to believe in something. And I came to believe in a sponsor. That's the only higher power I would accept. And he said, that's good enough. And I know all the arguments that say you should have that you can't believe in people. But it all depends on where you start. If you don't believe in nothing, you got to start somewhere. You better believe, if you can hang on to an arm and believe in that, that sure beats saying pretty words that you don't believe in. And this program is what? Going to come to believe that this higher power, this sponsor, this program, these steps is going to what? Restore me to sanity. What is sanity? Is there anybody here that's got a definition of sanity? You could read 500 psychiatric textbooks and you'll get 500 psychiatric definitions of what sanity is. Sanity is very hard to explain. I used to think sanity was the people who smiled all the time. You know. But I only met one guy that ever smiled all the time, and he was in the next bed to mine at Big Spring. And you want to know something? He ain't ever going to get out till he stops smiling. Because as long as he keeps smiling, he indicates he's not aware how bad things really are. Sanity is a pretty nebulous thing, but there's one thing that most authorities agree on in the field of medicine, and that is what insanity is. Insanity, or psychosis, is the withdrawal of the mind from reality that it can't cope with. And it's usually not a reversible situation. Every human being, I discovered, is like myself, has conflicts, up and down, up and down, up and down. Some of us are very lucky. We discover that we can resolve conflict by drinking alcohol, and that's fine. But eventually, alcohol starts to get to you, and then you got to give that up, and then you're left with conflicts you have no experience in coping with. But some people have these conflicts, and never drinking doesn't even help them. Can you imagine how rotten that must be to be a social drinker and have problems and have your back to the wall and have that old dragon you're married to giving it to you some more? And you pour a glass of whiskey and it doesn't do anything. It just goes blah, blah, blah. Now you're in trouble. You got your back to the wall. That old dragon is going at you and you're getting dizzy. They will never know what we take for granted. Everybody that raises their hand is an alcoholic. No matter how bad it gets, I can take a drink that goes boom. And now it may be a hell tomorrow, but tonight it's wonderful. Insanity, I guess, is where the brain, where the conflict level reaches a level that the nervous system cannot tolerate, so long and so strong that the mind superimposes an artificial environment. Sometimes this takes the form of paranoia or schizophrenia, which is jumping back and forth between personalities, or dementia praecox. Makes no difference. What it boils down to, the mind has to get away from reality and it withdraws from it. This rarely ever happens to alcoholics, I discovered, because alcoholics have the ability to induce insanity by pouring it. I'll never go crazy because I'll drive myself crazy drinking to keep from going crazy. It turns out that I drink to escape the same pain that causes psychosis. Now, for me to be restored to sanity is not any particular level of sobriety. It's to be allowed to live in the world, a crazy, suicidal, depressive goof like me. Somehow or other, they're going to tell me they're going to let me live in the world without having to induce psychosis chemically to stand it. I don't see how it can be done. But you don't have to see how it can be done. All you have to do is come to believe that it can be done. So I got to come here and admit that I have a problem drinking. I got to come here and say, even when I'm not drinking, I get screwed up. And then I got to say, somewhere here there's a power. I can't see it, and I'm not sure that I can understand it. But I got to try to believe that there's a power here that will enable me, with my ups and downs, my emotions and my fears and despair, sober, that will enable me to somehow hang on without having to drink. Now, if you could come that far, you get to the third step, and that's the spookiest step that ever was. You're going to make a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand it. There's God out in front, and you're going to turn your problems over to him. A classic example I know of that I've always thought of when I thought of that. That guy in Santa Monica many years ago said, I came to this program, I had about $105 in hot checks out. And I went down to the meeting and I said to an old timer, I can't cover these checks, what can I do? He says, turn it over to your higher power, son. And I turned over my higher power, and my higher power turned over to Sheriff Peter Pitches. I did a year and a day in Saugus, and I say to hell with it. Now, how are you going to turn something over when you're afraid and desperate and know you're going crazy? What are you going to do then? When I was about 6 months sober, I was fortunate enough through some intercession to get a job washing dishes at the Gaiety Delicatessen. And I lasted 3 days till I got discharged for cause. I've mentioned this before, but it's the same story I've always had. At that time, I was going through a little paranoid trip. I thought the busboy was getting dishes from other restaurants and bringing them in. It's funny now, but it wasn't funny then. I'd look over there, there'd be two guys eating sandwiches, and that goof would come around with a tray like that. I finally said, listen, you, I'm only going to do the dishes we're eating on here. You'll have to take your other, you know. So the guy fired me, is what he did. And that day I was going to commit suicide. Because I'd been sober 6 months. At the end of 6 months of sobriety, I was living in the back end of an abandoned car. I had no front teeth. I had a T-shirt. I didn't know what state my children were in. And my father hadn't talked to me. My mother hadn't talked to me for 8 years. I didn't have any friends that I could think of. I couldn't hold a job as a dishwasher. My mind was gone. I just wasn't ever going to spring back from those shock treatments. What the hell? I might as well die. So I was going to walk in the ocean. And I couldn't find the ocean that day. By the time I located it, the guy said it was 8 miles, and I said, to hell with that. You know, I don't mind committing suicide, but not 8 more miles, if you don't mind. So I got so desperate, I called up my sponsor. And I called him up, I said, Bob, I'm dying out here on Wilshire Boulevard. I said, I'm starving, I'm sick, and I weigh 115 pounds, and I haven't got a goddamn thing, and I'm living in the back seat of an abandoned car, and I've gone to goddamn meetings all the night, and I lost my job as a dishwasher. I said, what'll I do, Bob? He says, why don't you write your inventory? And I said, that caught my attention. I said, why don't you, whatever it was I suggested he do. And he really jumped on me. He says, you punk! And I said, Bob, you don't understand, in my judgment, writing an inventory isn't what I need. I need food. He says, in your judgment, he says, I don't care how it looks in your judgment stinks. If I want your judgment, I'll come down and call you. But you want my judgment. Now write an inventory. And he cursed me. He talked terribly to me. I made a vow right then. Someday when I get on top, I'm going to report this son of a bitch to the central office in New York. I'm really going to get him. Unfortunately, by the time I got the money to do it, he'd shaped up, fortunately. But he made me so mad that he said, "Kid, I want you to sublimate your judgment. Your judgment has left you nothing on the street. Sublimate your judgment. Turn off your judgment. Do what I tell you," he suggested. And I got so upset that I came out of that phone booth and I went right up 2 miles, right up the Miracle Mile, just. And I got to that AA club. I said, "Sullivan, give me some paper. I'm going to write my history line." And I wrote my inventory that day that I was so upset I didn't even edit it or write good thing. Just. And as a result of taking that inventory, nothing changed. I went to bed that night in the back seat of an abandoned car. Half a day hungrier than I had been. I didn't know what state my kids were in. My parents hadn't talked to me for 8 years. I had one thing that made me feel good. I'd proved that writing an inventory didn't help. That made me feel so good I went right to sleep. But in later days, I could look back on that day as one of the great turning spots in my life, because I'd been in and out of AA for 9.5 years by that time. I had taken my inventory, I said, with my analyst. I had taken my inventory with my psychologist. The only thing I had never got around to doing was writing an inventory the way AA said. And I sublimated my judgment to that old fool. And I look back and I bless that day, because it has seemed since then to me that the one excellent, irreplaceable tool in order for people like me to change is to allow somebody or something to superimpose a superior judgment over mine. If I use my judgment, then I am asking the same broken tool to fix itself. I'll take this broken screwdriver and screw itself together again, you know. And yet I have a tendency to do it. I would like to think that my sickness was when I was drunk. Everybody's sickness when they're drunk. Even amateur drinkers are goofy when they're drunk. What's the worst night of the year to be out? New Year's Eve. Because all those amateur drunks are out there. Amateur people who don't know when they're going to throw up. People who don't know when they're going to fall down. They will never know what we take for granted. Those amateurs, the first thing they know that they're going to throw up is all of a sudden it's on me. Anybody in this room knows when they're going to throw up. At least 30 seconds. That comes with experience. But I must somehow, if I'm going to change, I must allow something to superimpose its judgment over me. Because unless I can do that, I don't see how I can ever take a fourth step. Because in my judgment, a fourth step is the opposite of what I need. What I need is to forget these things, for God's sakes, not remember them. I can remember them too well. Just let me forget them. In my judgment, taking a fifth step is no therapy. How is it going to help somebody if I say to a guy, "Here's something you ought to know"? I used to go with a sheep outside of Butte, Montana.
That was not part of my fifth step. I'm wanted for suspicion of mopery in Dubuque, Iowa. That, you know. In my judgment, it doesn't help to ask God to be made perfect, because I'm afraid he'll turn me into one of those people I used to hate when I was little. I'll get little thin blue lips and little blue nose. And when people say hell, I'll go, And in my judgment, there's no therapy whatsoever in making amends to those dirty, rotten finks that threw it into me for 20 years. Here's $10 for calling the police on me that time. Want to thank you, darling, for signing that paper authorizing shock treatment. There's no therapy in meditation. I don't need any meditation. I try to avoid it. Most of my adult life I attempted to avoid meditation, because when I meditate more than 20 minutes, I want to kill myself. And there's no therapy in trying to work with other people till I get my own job taken care of. But each of these have been the result of sublimating my judgment in moments of stress and being forced to do things that later I took credit for, but at the time I didn't want to do. And I remember talking about that and telling people, you know, that's what AA is about. It's the sublimation of judgment. Forget this, you know, decisions to turn you, you know. Stay away from those spiritual steps. They're trouble. Sublimate your judgment. Sublimate your judgment. When I was about 2 years sober, I was up in San Francisco talking at some young people's meeting. It's hard to believe that I used to belong to the young people's group before I got bald. At that time, they were pretty frantic. They were just weirdos, and I was one of the leaders. And an old-timer was sitting in the back, and I got done with my harangue about sublimate your judgment. You got to sublimate your judgment. He came up after me and says, kid, he says, that's very good. He says, I've been sober 20 years. He says, I haven't heard that phrase, sublimate your judgment. That's very good. I hadn't had any front teeth yet, so I still had a smile. Thank you very much. And he says, I guess that's why they put it in the third step, didn't they, kid? And I said, oh, shut up. But that's exactly what the third step talks about. Made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him, or whatever higher power that I may be living with. I sublimated my judgment and turned my will over to my sponsor, who was my higher power. As a result of that, he began to have a chance to save my life. Later, I sublimated my judgment to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it began to have a chance to further work on my sanity. As a result of these things, something strange happened to me. Over a period of time, I came to believe in God. And I couldn't imagine how that would happen, except as the guy pointed out to me, you always thought you had to return to God. But you don't have to return to God, because when you have to return to something, that means you have to go back to a sick viewpoint you couldn't live with. What you have to do is come to believe where you are, maybe in the same God, but with a different and more mature perspective. I came to believe in a God, and I found myself doing things that I would have sworn I would never do as long as I live. I have never gone to sleep. I have not arisen without praying earnestly to that God for at least for over 10 years. I remember the first night I prayed. I prayed because an old foul-mouthed Army sergeant in the men's stag said, you gotta find a God to pray you. No matter what you call us, son of a bitch, you gotta find a God to pray you. And I went home and I prayed that night, and I never stopped since. Now, these are all terrible motives to pray. But I have come to believe in God, and I hope that today, if this is followed to the regular pattern, I have turned my will and my life over to God as I understand Him, the best I've ever done. Not as good as I'm going to do next month, and maybe not as good as I'm going to do next week, but better than I used to do. And the rewards of this have been, you know, we talk about rewards in AA, and I have a lot of overt rewards. I am no longer an out-of-work dishwasher. I am an executive in a big corporation. When I get mad at non-alcoholics, I order them to come into my office and make them jump. Okay. All right, you people, jump. I don't actually say it, but I think about it, you know. The same family, my father and mother that I didn't see for many years, we were very close. In fact, a couple weeks ago, I was down Corpus Christi and I had a wonderful opportunity. The next day was my father's birthday and I had a chance to fly in and surprise him, knock on his door at dinner time and say, "Happy birthday, Dad," and take him out to dinner because we're very close and have been for many years. My mother and I are very close. When I was sober 5 years, my wife and four little daughters, who turned into four big daughters, moved from Dallas out to California. And we live in a house that I own by the ocean, where the tidal wave will come. We have four cats and five dogs now. We have a new dog and a goat, the only goat in the city of Los Angeles. A backyard full of AAs, they're there today. They don't even notice I'm gone. They're out there playing volleyball and having fun. They better get the lawn mowed before they do it. And I'm getting along fine. You know, I'm getting along fine. The only bad moment I've had for 6 months was riding Texas International Airlines into Longview. I thought their rubber band had broke for a while. I was glad I was in the habit of praying when I got on that plane, I'll tell you, because I mastered it by the time I got off. But I could say, that's what you get by working the steps. You get things. You get to talk pretty. You can go around and talk about how wonderful everything is. But that isn't the miracle that's happened to me. The miracle that's happened to me is that for 12 and a half years, I have not only been living without being driven insane by reality, but living progressively more comfortably. I haven't seriously contemplated a drink. I've thought about a drink from time to time, but I haven't seriously had to fight a drink for 10 years. But I've thought about a drink. People who never think about a drink are different than I am. On a hot summer day and I'm driving up that freeway and there's a big billboard that shows a guy with a big bottle of Hams with stuff on the outside of it. And I have a tendency to salivate just to... But not for the effect, just for the taste. That's a switch. Part of my job is buying people booze. I go around as the glad hander. Have another drink, Charlie, and sign that contract. You know. And I have no temptation to drink it. To this day, however, I don't have any alcohol in my house overnight. I'm not against it. When my daughter got married, I had a big champagne bust in our backyard. But I kept the champagne in the garage the night before, because anytime I want to get up in the middle of the night to get a drink, I want cold air to hit my face before I drink it. Because I've watched a good friend of mine who, after 9 years, just got up in the middle of the night, half asleep on the kitchen, poured a drink. By the time he woke up, he was dying. You know, that's maybe you shouldn't have to be that way, but that's the way I am. But the greatest reward of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's not to be the most beautiful talker. I could give a much more beautiful talk than I gave tonight. I could lay words on you that would just make you quiver. You know. That's what I do for a living. I write. I'm a writer. I can write beautiful words and put string phrases together, and I could just give you a mouthful of meringue to take with you. You know. But I am progressively more aware that you and I, and all of us, in my opinion, have to start remembering what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with one thing that people like you and I can't deal with, and that is the ups and downs of living out there in the world. You don't need AA between 7 o'clock and 9 o'clock tonight. We got each other and we're protected. Where you need AA is after you go out there and you go home. And they ain't all working the steps. And you can't go into your market man and say, "You want to know something? I'm secretly depressed today." And when the policeman gives you a ticket, you can't say, "You're going to give me a resentment, officer." He doesn't care. And if you don't get to work on time in the morning enough times, no matter how many spiritual things you've been doing at night, they're going to fire your butt. They don't care. They don't care. Alcoholics Anonymous, being a master of Alcoholics Anonymous is not what we are here for, I believe. It's little by little to take these lessons out there in the world that used to be full of tigers and see if we can't tame those tigers and turn them into pussycats once in a while anyway, so that I can live in a world that becomes more comfortable. And most importantly of all, to keep active in this organization so that I can find the most valuable gift I've ever been given. This is the one gift I don't recall working for in AA, and that is the gift of enthusiasm. I watch people that I got sober with who are now jaded and they don't have time for meetings, who have become successful, who got wrapped up in their careers. I'm not against that. I work too. Who don't have time for the AAs. And I used to do those things, but I'd not anymore, and I haven't been to a meeting for a couple of years. These are old-timers in my book who one day are going to say, "Did you hear about Al? He got drunk after 20 years. I hope it doesn't happen to me. I want to maintain enthusiasm towards AA. Not to impress you, because tomorrow I'm going to be out of here. You know, you can love me or hate me. If you love me, just send money to my home in California." But for God's sakes, don't get engaged in these podium competitions of which manifest themselves in two ways. One, my story is worse than yours, and that's all I'm ever going to talk about. Or secondly, I can say more spiritual things than you can, no matter how bad I feel. This is the only place we got to go and be sick, for Christ's sake. This is where we can share how we really feel. Not everybody feels good all the time. Not everybody feels bad all the time. The purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is that it is a fellowship of men and women who gather together to share their experience, strength, and hope in sobriety so that we may individually go live in the world as functioning, integrating human beings. The best gift I have gotten from this program is not money, property, nor prestige, but the mere fact that when I go out the door following an AA meeting, I'm going into a world that I deserve to be in, that I can live in comfortably, that I never have to look over my shoulder to see if they found out about me now, that I can be that I can be a grandfather to my new little granddaughter, that I can be a father to my children, that I can be a friend to my friends. These are all very nice, but most importantly, the one thing that you and I, it seems to me, must always have is the belief that even I am worth saving, no matter how bad it gets. And that I don't have to drink, and I don't have to take pills. And if I can maintain that enthusiasm, it's a funny thing about the word, I'm sure that you are aware of it. The word enthusiasm comes from entheos, which means the God within. I seek the God without to help me activate the God within. that enthusiastically I can say, tonight I am going to try to remember the things I have told you. Tomorrow you'll have another speaker and an excellent one in the morning. And you had an excellent one this afternoon, an excellent one this morning. But this is the only philosophy I have. That is that I must walk a little bit straighter tomorrow than I did today. Not so that I'll get invited to speak at a convention, but so that when I go to bed tomorrow night, I can say, my name is Clancy Immelman, and I am an alcoholic, and thank you, God, for keeping me alive. Thank you.